We talked to a fair number of people who wrote books about their lives. By and large, the books are interesting and engaging, but that's got a lot to do with how the stories are told. When you stop to think about it, maybe a book about life working in the family restaurant doesn't sound like a gripping yarn, but we featured such a book and author a couple of years ago. The point, you need not live a fascinating life to tell an interesting story about it, or two. Today's guest wants to put the power of the memoir into all of our hands. Alan Gelb is the author of Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. Alan is a published author several times over, a writing coach, and the author of Conquering the College Admissions Essay in 10 Steps. Alan Gelb, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. As far as how-to books go, this is a very different one from your last one. What spurred this on?
Well, it's, in a sense, not all that different from the last one. In fact, it builds on the work that I've been doing for years with students. 17 and 18-year-old students who are applying to college are asked to do a life review exercise. They're asked to pick a moment out of their lives that will reflect them to the admissions folks in a way that's positive. And I wrote this book back in 2008 that has been successful because it really help students understand how to tell a narrative, how to capture their message in a story, what the elements of a story are. As I've grown older, I find myself, unfortunately, sitting more at the memorial services and funeral services of friends and family, and I always appreciate what I hear about the person from those who are speaking. But I always feel like I want to hear the voice of that person one more time. And that was sort of an aha moment for me, and I realized that I could take what I do with 17-year-olds, that life review exercise, in a short space, 500 to 1,000 words, and apply it to people my age and older.
You mentioned attending funeral services with a critical eye. This must be an interesting feeling.
I'm probably the only person who does that. I'm ashamed to admit, yes.
And so you just, but the point is you didn't hear the voice, in a sense, of the person who had died.
Yeah, I wanted to hear that voice one more time, have that presence in the room. And even though, you know, eulogies can be incredibly moving and fascinating, they're different than hearing the voice of the person.
Tell us about, you bring up the topic of ethical wills in the Jewish tradition. Tell us about what those are and how those figure in this discussion.
Right. That, for me, made a good hook for this work to tell these stories based on an ethical value that you've lived by. And I picked up on a tradition out of Judaism, which is my tradition, which goes back to Genesis. Jacob gave an ethical will to his sons. What they are documents that are meant to convey your wills, your values to your descendants, to essentially and hopefully instruct them how to live. These ethical wills have been used in Judaism for, as I say, thousands of years. They have usually been done in letters or legal documents. And in recent times, they've been part of the Jewish renewal movement. They've been a more creative slant on them, but they've also been adopted by in the secular world by estate planners, financial planners who use them for gaining clarity on what the person wants.
Is it more a sense of a list of directions, though, rather than the narrative that you talk about?
Yes, it's entirely that. It's basically a statement of what you would like people to how you would like people to live, how you've lived in a way that you felt was ethical and valuable, and how you would like your descendants to do the same.
So once you decided to move ahead and move into a project where you were doing what you'd done with 16 and 17-year-olds and do it for pretty much everybody, tell us about the group of older adults that you gathered for a run at this.
Well, I had to gather together some people I knew who would be willing to be guinea pigs. And I, you know, at first I thought, well, are they going to receive this assignment as, you know, a bit macabre, you know, writing your last say? How would they react to it? Surprisingly and pleasantly, they really wanted to do it. They plunged right into it. I modeled a piece, so I wrote a piece so that they could see what it would be like, and that was, of course, challenging for me, and I could talk more about that in a moment. But what we did is gather as a group, and so this work, as compared to the work I do with the younger people, which is essentially one-on-one, this work has a more social model built into it. So we gather together at the beginning to lay out the process. We disperse to do our work individually, in which I kind of coached some of these people. And then we gathered together at the end to share the finished pieces. So the added benefit of this was that other people got to see insights into how their peers were approaching what I call life's third act.
The idea of plucking out a moment of your life, though, I can imagine it's difficult for anybody, for different reasons, though, for the 16- and 17-year-olds and for the older adults. The 16- and 17-year-olds probably are thinking, well, I haven't really done anything in some cases. And the older adults are thinking, oh, my God, I've done so many things.
Well, one of the most prevalent responses I get from the 17-year-olds is I have nothing to write about. And then and that's never true. Everybody has something to write about. What I get from the older people is, how do I do this? There's so much that has gone on in my life. What I have in both books is, and actually there's some repetition in questions from one book to the other, is a set of exploratory questions. There's about 30 of them. They're all over the place. They're far-ranging. They go from, things like, when has my mind and body ever felt in perfect harmony? Have I ever changed the course of someone else's life? What's my idea of a perfect day? If I can't sleep at night, what's keeping me up? There's like 30 of these questions. They're provocative. They're surprising. And the writers answer these questions. And then they, on your own, if you're not working with me, you go back to them after a few days and see what's pulling you.
And from that, you can begin to develop a narrative. That is the process described in Alan Gelb's Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. We'll come back and talk a lot more with Alan and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about writing our own life stories in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about writing down our own life stories. Not the whole thing necessarily, but, picking an episode in your life that's symbolic to you of what your life has meant and things you might have learned or taught other people. Alan Gelb encourages us through this process through his book, Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. If you have some questions about process, join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Share your stories as well. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Alan, you sold cemetery plots. How'd that come about?
Well, I referred to my Jewish tradition a few minutes ago, and I have been a member of a synagogue in the small rural town in upstate New York where I live. I'm one of the founders of that synagogue 15 years ago, and it's an all-volunteer organization. At some point, we started a Jewish section of a municipal cemetery in town, and so I am the cemetery plot salesman. Yes, that's what I am.
But you say this...
Interested, Jeff?
Maybe. I'm actually a New York native.
Oh, really?
From Levittown.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So, so what did this process, though, of selling cemetery plots teach you about how ready people are to consider the milestones of old age, or not perhaps ready?
Highly unready by and large. Most people don't really want to do that particular part of the work until very late in the story, or even have it done for them after the story. So not a lot of preparedness. However, on the other hand, the baby boomers as a generation is approaching aging in a way that I think is radically different than the generations that came before. And we see a lot of this. There's a lot going on out in the ozone there. There are people gathering together in small groups, even strangers, to have what's being called death over dinner, death cafes, discussing end-of-life planning. My reading group that's been going on for 25 years in my town here, and we've sort of you know, gotten older together. Last night we read Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. Don't know if you know that
yeah,
or not.
Yeah, I do. Great author, yeah.
Incredible. And so we're having these discussions, and, you know, I think another aspect of my book is that it enables people to have a vehicle for having those discussions. You know, often at a certain age you get together with friends and you start talking about, you know, operations and knee replacements and stuff, and somebody will say, we ought to have a group to discuss this, you know, but it doesn't happen. And I think that this work, this last say work, enables people to do some of that sharing at least.
You mentioned the boomeritis, where the baby boomers will get athletic injuries late in life because they haven't quite agreed to slow down as their bodies might have been telling them to. And you mentioned a bout of this yourself, too. But compare boomeritis, for example, and the physical stretching with the mental and emotional stretching involved in the memoir process.
Mental and emotional stretching is absolutely great for you, and you should keep doing it until the very last moment, I think. So my uncle died this year at the age of 92 or something, and he had just finished a book right before he died, and he believed that you work until the very last moment. Now, that's a bit of an extreme, but I do think, you know, that this work of reflection and gaining perspective on your life is enormously helpful and makes it much easier to go into the period of your life when there's loss and dislocation and sometimes chaos.
So by this point in the book, you know, any reader is thinking, well, it sounds great. Okay, let's get about doing this writing thing. And then you pull this other boat up alongside us and remind us that, oh, yeah, the whole world writes on the Internet now. How is this different?
Well, this is a very crafted piece of writing. I'm not knocking people writing on the Internet, and blogging is, you know, great if you enjoy it, and there are great blogs, for sure. But this is different in the sense that this is a formal piece of writing. You're going to take on an assignment, and you're going to sort of follow certain guidelines in order to produce, you know, work at a certain level. And what's amazed me with my 17-year-olds and my 70-year-olds is the level of writing that they can achieve if they understand the form that they're working in, because the narrative is a form, like a golf swing, like a dance move, and if you understand that form, it's like a revelation, and you can feel so much more empowered to do that work.
So getting a handle on narrative form, when we say narrative, what do we mean?
We mean a story, and that's the form that people have responded to from the very dawn of time. That's why, you know, there were certain people back in the cave dweller times who were popular because they told great stories around the campfire. So some people are natural storytellers, and we know who those people are, and some people have a really difficult time telling a joke, and we know, which is a narrative, and we know who those people are. But those people who are not so gifted at, naturally gifted, can learn to become better at it if they understand the elements, which I've distilled down to four elements.
Okay, we'll get to the four elements in a moment. I want to ask, though, about the power of narratives, because there's some interesting stuff you provide in here about the findings about kids, for example, who know the narrative about how their parents met.
Exactly. I mean, there have been studies that have shown that families in which stories are shared, particularly stories about their upbringings and childhoods, if they share that with their children or their grandchildren, which I just did the other day with my 3-year-old grandson, putting him to bed.
Wow.
And telling him about his daddy and his daddy's dog, that there's an actual sort of empirical heightening of emotional health among children that have had that experience. So, yeah, it's powerful.
We're talking to Alan Gelb about writing our own life stories down. His book is Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. So the four basic elements of narrative that you mentioned.
Right. So the first one that I identify is called the once. Where do you pick up the story? You have 600, let's say 600 words to work with, or 700 words to work with. That's not a lot of space. So you have to decide where in the arc of time you're going to pick up your story. And I find when I work with writers, that we immediately in the first draft can knock out a couple of the paragraphs at the beginning, because that's stuff that they may need to know about, sort of what we call backstory, but not necessarily stuff that the reader needs to know about. We might actually plunge right into the action with the literary device known as in media res in the middle of things. And so there's that to be dealt with, and that's a structural issue. The second element I identify is called the extraordinary versus the ordinary. If nothing extraordinary happens in a story, and by extraordinary I mean out of the ordinary, then a story is not happening. It doesn't happen. There needs to be a trigger to get the story going. The third piece is tension and conflict. That's why people read literature, because they're interested in conflict. They're interested to see how human beings resolve conflict. That's why we respond to Hamlet. That's why we respond to The Sopranos. It's the same thing. How do people work out these issues? And the fourth crucial element is the point. Often writers will write something and they don't really understand why they wrote that piece. And if they don't understand it, if they don't understand the point, others will not get it either.
Is there any particular one of these, Alan, that you feel like most people don't quite get the first time through?
I think the ones that are problematic is the once, because that's a technical issue. So, people often who are not experienced writers may tell a story in a very linear fashion, which can work. But on the other hand, I'll sometimes show a writer that you can start at the end of the story and then work backwards and look what happened.
Huh.
Yeah.
And how about the point? I mean, for one thing, it's not like a punchline. I mean, you're not trying to like, hey, this is why this will happen, bang, boom. You're not trying to send them out laughing, right?
The point doesn't need to be explicitly stated, although sometimes it's powerful if it is. But sometimes the point will not emerge until you get a hold of the structure. If things are kind of like all over the place and feels messy in your head, you're not going to understand the point. And as you go along, as the thing becomes cleaner and the bones of the piece, really visibly emerge, then you can get a better sense of, what is this thing I'm writing?
And it does help that you provide some examples for us from your own life. And we can see right away from your flat tire story, you tend to gain new perspective on life in the telling.
Exactly. I mean, this has been very powerful for all the people I've worked with, including myself, because I told a story, the one that I wrote to model, and I didn't know really why I told it until I didn't really know why it stayed in my mind as it had until I told the story and it became clear to me. And I was appreciative of the fact that I gained clarity on it.
We'll have to read the book to get the flat tire story, but we're talking to Alan Gelb about his book, Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. In fact, we were just talking about the flat tire story and how that you get to reinterpret some things in your life through the telling of it. Natalie Goldberg talks about writers living twice.
Mm-hmm. I like that quote, yes. I think that, that's like, why do people write? Well, people write for all kinds of reasons. They write to confess, they write to forgive, they write to arouse, to amuse, to gain perspective on a tradition or a folkway, to explore a world issue or a problem. But they also write, I think, for because of what Natalie talks about as a wish to continue in some fashion. And these pieces actually can become heirlooms, these last says, that can be shared with future generations. Look who your grandfather was. Look who your great-grandfather was. It's powerful.
Is this something that you intend for people to make available for their funerals or to put in a box someplace so people will read it after they're gone? Or something?
They can be shared in any number of ways, Jeff. I mean, certainly somebody could write one and they could put it away until they're gone, and it can be read posthumously. They can be shared with people. Some of my writers have told me that they've shared them already with family members at the Thanksgiving table, let's say, and they were, everybody was, visibly moved. I call them last says, but that's kind of a conceit. These aren't necessarily have to be your final say. You could keep writing them if you were inspired to, and maybe you'll find another one that's even more reflective of who you are and more the one that you want to have read at your funeral service, if that is a desire.
Your sample story of riding the train to Wassaic with your son, just one episode here, is your basic advice in the book to write a bunch of these or just pick one thing to write about in the first place?
I think it depends on the capacity and the interest. I wanted to stress, and you mentioned that at the beginning, that this work is for the unidentified writer. It's not for somebody who's been doing memoirs and journaling, and that's absolutely terrific for people who are doing those things. I have utmost respect for that. But most people in the world are not doing that. On the other hand, many people in the world may have a feeling that they want to express something that has gone unexpressed, and this work allows the novice, the unidentified, the amateur writer to do that work.
And once you've chosen what to write about, you can think, oh, yeah, there was that time that X happened. I mean, then how do you prime the pump and get yourself going?
Well, I think one way that you can really start to do that is to understand the writing process. So the book, the book starts with the theory. You know, what is a narrative? Then it goes on to how to find that topic. Once you've found that topic, then you go into the actual work, and the book lays out the drafting process. So, you know, people have heard terms like first draft and second draft, but they don't necessarily know what it means or what goes on in those stages. And this book tells you what goes on in those stages. So, you know, the first draft is more, the work is more structural in nature. Second draft, you might start looking at tone more. Third draft, you might start looking at specific language issues like word choice and syntax and things like that. And so if you have a sense of the continuum that you're entering into, it becomes a little less frightening, I think, although writing is frightening. You know, I also talk about that in the book, the fact that, you know, every writer, you know, professional or amateur, experiences an element of fear when you go into that blankness. And there are ways to deal with that, you know, to accept it, to understand when you're procrastinating, to have various techniques that you use to combat procrastination.
Is it procrastination, or is it just not knowing what you're going to write, or are they just symptoms of each other?
I think they're very linked. I think people feel fearful around writing and fearful around their abilities, and, you know, there may be reasons for that, historical reasons. They've been told they're not good writers, let's say. But, you know, again, with the understanding of what is actually going on, what the form is and what the process is, you know, you've got a good foundation for doing the work, and if you apply yourself, you should be pretty successful with it.
And we shouldn't feel bad about procrastination, because you tick off the names of a couple people who are famous procrastinators. I love the details of Victor Hugo. What did he do to finally get himself to write?
He was naked. That's right. He worked naked so that he couldn't go out of the house. And I think he would have, at the end of the day, he would have his manservant bring him his clothes so that he could go to the bar.
And have him take him away in the first place, so he had to write.
That's right.
That's some great stuff here. Alan Gelb, we assume, writes with clothing on. His book is Having the Last Say.
That's Capturing. Right, they do, yes.
Yeah, all right, good to thanks for adding that in here. Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. The concept of relevancy for older people is a constant theme of the fact that these are people getting on in years you're most trying to appeal to here. When you talk about relevancy for older folks, what's the context here? How does it relate to this project?
Well, you know, it goes, I think we're talking about being seen, really. And, you know, we've heard stories of, you know, I've heard women talk about the fact that, you know, it suddenly hits them that they're walking down the street and they feel like men aren't looking at them anymore. And that's painful, you know. But that, which is very out there, is also a sensation that people feel in many other ways, that they're not being heard when they talk in a meeting, let's say. I do a lot of work writing for colleges and universities. I write recruitment material and development material. I'm 65. When I go to a meeting, the first time I go to a meeting and there's all the various staff there, I'm 30 years older than a lot of them. So they look at me, you know, like, why are you here and what are you going to say? But when I start talking and I have something to say, then the relevancy issue, you know, goes away and we become communicators. So I think people are, as they get older, worry about that. They also feel like, you know, I don't know as much about the world as I used to. You know, I don't understand. I used to know every movie star in the world. Okay, that was my thing. I could be in an elevator with some of these people. I wouldn't know who they are.
All right. I know that, you know, if it helps you feel any better, we were talking to a journalist about neuroscience last week, and it turns out there's this thing called the remembrance bump between the ages of about 10 and 30 when you're busy having kids and doing all the important things of setting up a life. Mm-hmm. Those are the things you remember the best.
Right.
The stuff before age 10 and after age 30, not so much.
Interesting.
So in terms of then trying to get over your own remembrance bump and remember things in your own life, then, I mean, does the story have to be positive, or is it sometimes better if it's not?
I found, Jeff, that people tend to go in the direction of the positive, I think because they feel like they want to feel that feeling and they want to have others feel that about them. And, you know, life is for most people a mix of positive and negative, so it's not that hard to find something positive if you care to. But there certainly is room for there to be last says that deal with painful issues and failure and loss.
Much more to talk about the subject of last says. Having the Last Say is Alan Gelb's book, subtitled Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. We'll come back and talk more with Alan about choices we make, about the stories we choose to tell, and how we go about telling those. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Alan Gelb and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about putting our own thoughts about our own life down in narrative form, short narrative form, about specific moments in our life or incidents in our life. Alan Gelb is our guide. He's written a book called Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the process and the choosing of incidents to write about with Alan. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Your stories are welcome here at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm sure a few people, Alan, will say back to you in this process, I haven't had a lot of conflict in my life. What do you say to that?
I hear that from the 17-year-olds, Jeff. I don't hear that from the older population I work with, because by the time you get to be in your 60s or so, if you haven't had conflict, then you've been in a little bit of a bubble, I think.
Has anybody gone to seek therapy because of this process, though? Were they, oh, my God, I just had to think about this incident for the first time in years.
I don't know about that, although I think that there's some therapy involved in the process, particularly when you're using the social model that I described. It gets to be a bit of a consciousness raising group or whatever.
So talk about the importance of honesty in this process. I mean, how closely should we stick to the real events and not add details or people or overstate our own importance or role in the things we're writing about?
Well, I think that's absolutely critical. I mean, the whole point of this is authenticity, which is exactly the same thing I say to these 17-year-olds. The first thing I say to 17-year-olds is that this work has to be authentic. It has to be your voice. If you go to an essay writing service, you're going to get absolutely the opposite. Somebody's going to do it for you or going to point you towards a menu or something like that. With the older population, again, yes, authenticity. This is not an occasion for promoting your achievements, touting your good deeds. This is a time to tell a story that's going to connect emotionally with the reader listener, and that's the work.
How confessional do you recommend people get in these?
As confessional as they want to. I've had people, I was actually surprised and kind of really moved, because when the book was going to be published, I contacted all the people whose pieces I wanted to use, and I said, would you allow me to use it, and will you sign here in the dotted line so that you don't sue me? And they agreed to do that. And they also agreed to have their names, except for one case. They agreed, all eight people agreed to have their names used, cited on the page, the acknowledgement page. And some of the material was very, 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 very personal. You know, people talking about, there's an essay in the book, for instance, about a woman who is singing in a choir, and she is somebody who has emphysema from years of smoking. And she, the essay is really about the joy she takes in singing in the choir, and the ethical value is about forgiving herself for her past mistakes. So yes, it's a positive piece, but it explores, you know, deeply personal material. Another story in the book is about a woman who formed a bond with a younger woman when the two of them were in a group for people with eating disorders. So I'm talking about, you know, really personal stuff here. And I think what happens is that there's a sense of empowerment. I used that word before, but there definitely is that feeling like, you know, I did this piece, I owned it, it is who I am, and I feel good about it.
So empowerment and a sense of uplift, it sounds like, for some people, in telling things that they really haven't told many people,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of uplift. I like that word.
We have a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alan Gelb, the author of Having the Last Say.
Thanks. I hope this question applies to your guest. My mom's 96. Physically, she's great. She still knows who we are, but man, is she confused. And I don't know whether writing stuff down would help her. I know that people who are elderly, their long-term memory is okay. Short is terrible, but she's got such wild ideas, like her parents are coming to visit her from Ashland, which would not be possible. Anyway, that's my question.
Do I
straighten her out or just let it go? Or I don't know if this even applies to what you're talking about, but thank you, sir.
Well, John, I think, you know, there's she won't be able to do the work that's described in this book, but if you point her in the direction of perhaps helping her to capture a memory that you feel would be pleasurable for her. I have a mother-in-law who lived with us who had Alzheimer's, and we would talk about things in the past, and she could remember and take pleasure from the time she went there or saw that, you know? So I think that is therapeutic in that situation. You know, as far as people, there's a window of opportunity for doing that. This work that's demanding, you know, intellectually demanding, and clearly she's not in that place right now. But I am actually interested in working with people using this method who are chronically ill, you know, so we'll see what happens.
So do you do some of this in an oral history sense where you will have somebody else tell the story and a second person writes it down?
I have not done that, but, you know, it's conceivable.
So there are some basic mechanics in this process that you talked to. I mean, you really get down to the nuts and bolts of how to go about this. Like which person? Any reason not to write your stories in first person?
Well, you know, I mentioned that story about the woman who formed a bond with the young woman in the eating disorders group. And she did an interesting thing. And that's a point of view issue, Jeff, that you're talking about, the tense. Point of view is you know, which person you're going to... I mean, point of view has several elements. One is... are you going to tell it first person or third person? You're not going to tell it second person. Nobody does.
You don't do that.
No. It could be done, but it's very, very experimental and not within the competency of the average writer. Another point of view issue is it going to be present tense or past tense, let's say. So these are issues that you deal with that I discuss in the book. As far as your question about first or third person, this writer who did the piece about the eating disorder group started it in the third person, and then she transitioned it to the first person. So it was sort of like she captured memory that she saw through a third-person lens, and then she reflected on it through a first-person voice, and it was very powerful.
We have an email here from Mike in Medford. I think he's asking about something a little longer than 600 or 700 words. He says, a few years ago, I wrote a narrative nonfiction about a crazy three-week journey in my life. Because I'm not a professional editor and don't have the money for professional editing, I just left it to sit, finished, but unedited. Do you recommend any way to cost-effectively edit and get the story out?
Well, you know, hiring an editor in any sense would be expensive, so I don't know about cost-effective. But, you know... that's something that he could pick a moment out of that story and try one of these. That's certainly an option, you know. Take a small moment out of his, was it a three-month journey or a three-week journey?
Three-week journey, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and pick a moment out of it. I have people do that all the time. So, you know, they take a trip to Costa Rica and they pick out a moment from that trip and they observe very closely the facets of that moment, what's happening emotionally, what's happening psychologically in that moment, and that's what the story is.
600, 700 words is what you mentioned before. Is that about a page, basically, on a computer?
I would say it's a couple pages.
Mm-hmm. All right. You use the term free writing in here. What does that mean?
Free writing is one of the, we talked a little earlier about, you know, how to get over the hump when you're starting a piece of work, and I was talking about procrastination busters and things like that. So the free writing is a technique in which you set yourself a time, let's say 5 minutes, let's say 10 minutes, and you simply write whatever comes to your mind. You do not think about any rules, any commas, any punctuation, spelling, all of that goes out the window. And you just write. It's sort of like, you know, free association in a sense. And then you stop, and it sort of limbers you up because you saw that you just did something that you were afraid of for 10 minutes, even if there's nothing to be gained out of it. But there's often something to be gained out of it in the sense of an image, a turn of phrase that maybe leads you somewhere else when you go back to look at it.
Is there a sweet spot, a magic number for the number of drafts you think that it takes to get a piece in its close to its best form anyway?
I find typically that people can sort of get it done in about 3 drafts. And, you know, when people ask me how long does it take to do this work, whether they're 17 or 70, I say that it, think about it as a couple of weeks, okay, because you want to allow the drafts to sort of sit a little bit, perk up, you know, kind of, you don't want to rush this process, but the aggregate number of hours that it takes to do this work is maybe something like 7 or 8 hours, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so not too much time. Mm-hmm. There was a trick you mentioned here to writing the first draft. Tell us what you recommend there.
Let me think. What is that trick?
Compose it as if you're writing to somebody else, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, that's a nice trick, yes. I've gotten people who have been really stuck, and I say, well, you know, try writing it as an email. You write a lot of emails, right? Write an email to a friend. See what comes out. And that can often be quite effective.
What are the frequent pitfalls? I mean, some of the things that will mess up most writers in this process.
The most frequent pitfalls I find is, one of the most frequent issues is the language itself, people getting stuck inside the language. And, you know, there's so many really kind of simple and quick ways of remedying writing that's not working. Just something as simple as a sentence structure pointer, like, you know, start your sentences with a noun and a verb. I went here, I went there. So many people start with, you know, a prepositional phrase, you know, going down the road, and they get lost when they're in the middle of the sentence. So I always tell writers, one of the first things I tell them is that readers will never hold simple language against you, good, clean, simple language. They'll never hold that against you. What they will hold against you is the thorny, tangled stuff. And, in fact, I have a piece that's going to be coming out quite soon in both the print and the web version of the magazine, The Writer, called 'Tis the Gift to Be Simple, you know. It's fine. It's great, you know. Drop the adverbial phrases. Drop the adjectives. Just keep it nice and simple.
It doesn't have to start like, you know, it was the early weeks of May when the dew clung heavy to the petals of the flowers, that kind of thing.
Yes, please don't do that.
So then when you're looking at your own work, how to find the right level of criticism, not savaging everything, but cutting the bad stuff out?
Yeah. Well, you know, I talk in the book about feedback and accepting critical feedback, which is can be complicated. So what I urge people to do is find people in their lives who are who they see as seasoned readers. You know, if you have a friend or a spouse who's in a reading group, give it to that person. That's a person to whom writing matters, you know, and that person hopefully will have some decent critical judgment. That's one way of doing it. And also, for sure, always reading your drafts out loud, because you hear things when you read out loud that you cannot pick up when you're just reading them, you know, on a screen or on a page.
One of the keys to writing for broadcast, I should point out, too, because you realize some of the stupid things you do in your writing when you say them out loud.
Yeah, yeah.
So when to read it out loud to yourself, and when to read it to someone else?
I read it out loud to myself often, you know, as I go along. When I work on an essay with a student, I read it out loud sometimes, not always, but, you know, if it's not really clicking for some reason. I'll read it out loud and so that my ear can hear what my eye's not seeing. And what was the other part of the question, Jeff?
When to read it to someone else.
Okay, yeah, that you should probably try to hold to late in the process, because when you start getting input from people, it can be hard to process. And, you know, if you stay with the process as it's laid out, if you sort of follow these steps, it's kind of a formula that I present. In fact, and I say there's a similarity with both of these populations that I work with, but, you know, with that younger population, I work with a lot of students, these STEM students, you know, science, technology, engineering, mm-hmm. math students, and they really respond to this because there's a formula involved in this that leads you to something that's absolutely the opposite of formulaic. It's kind of a paradox. It's interesting.
It is interesting. So you're taking all these mechanics involved, but you're coming up with something that is by no means mechanical.
Yes, because if you understand the mechanics, if you understand the structure, if you understand the form, then you can go on with more freedom to the expression.
Alan, any estimate on how many people, both among your 17-year-olds and your 70-year-olds, you've gotten through this process now, who've gone ahead and written their own last essays?
With the 17-year-olds, I've had, you know, hundreds and hundreds. I work with students all over the world. What I do is completely unbound by geography, which is really nice and interesting for me. So, yes, that's a population that I know in and out. This older population is much newer for me. I've just been doing it over the last year or two, and the book has just come out.
The book is just out. It's called Having the Last Say, Capturing Your Legacy in One Small Story. Alan Gelb is our guide, the author, and our guest on The Exchange today. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.